Welcome to Minority Corner, where we take an introspective look at the world through an intersectional lens. I'm James, he, him. I'm a queer political activist, actor, comedian, self-proclaimed sexy blurred. That's a black nerd. And each week, I'm joined in the corner by other fabulous minorities and some allies tackling the news, pop culture, politics, media, entertainment, and history with a little self-care, self-love sprinkled throughout, all for our own personal and collective empowerment. This week on Minority Corner, we are back in action with Teresa Atteridge. There was too much to continue talking about. We continue our conversations from last week. She was on here last week. You know her, you love her. She's our biracial, bicoastal, bisexual, proud AAPI actor, writer, and lover of spam. We dive right into what you've been wanting us to dive into, a Cheetah Girls rabbit hole. Oh, yes, we're going there and you're coming with us. We've got our theories. Are we rooting for everybody? Even Stacey Dash? We discuss. And Teresa gives us more of her experiences in terms of the reckoning that is happening specifically towards the AAPI community and how this is actually affecting the AAPI community in regards to millennials. We talk about the work that lies ahead, healing the divide between the Black and AAPI community, what needs to happen next. We talk about the murder of George Floyd trial happening right now. And then I lead us through the history of the murder of Vincent Chin that happened in the 1980s and this landmark moment for the AAPI community that united them and the ripple effects that this murder and the case around it created. Very much parallels to things that are happening today, especially when you look at the murder of George Floyd, as well as though Vincent Chin was not necessarily involving police, but white supremacy. And we really dive into the caste system at work because that is the work to unpack here. But first, before we jump into the show, a few little headlines here at the top of the show, doing things a little bit different. I just want to make sure this is on everyone's radar because this broke my heart. You know, there has been a rise of anti-trans youth bills in particular, but just a lot of rise in anti-trans laws that have been happening. And Arkansas this week became the first state in the country to outlaw gender-affirming health care to trans youth. Now, earlier in the week, it assumed that some sort of progressive moment happened when the governor, Asa Hutchinson, vetoed the House bill, House Bill 1570, which bans doctors from providing essential health care services like gender-affirming surgery or hormone therapy for trans youth under the age of 18. So everyone's like, yay, okay, you're on board. That wasn't it exactly. Asa Hutchinson vetoed it knowing that it would go back to the state legislature and they were probably going to override the veto. And I do believe there was something around the effect of, I'm not going to give Governor Asa Hutchinson all the snaps on this one because for them, they were afraid it was going to infringe on some other like crazy sort of rights that do not align with my own personal progressive ideology. So I was not waving the victory flag there. And so on Tuesday, the state's Republican controlled legislature voted to override the governor's veto and effectively it passed the law. And there's just a wave of Republican shenanigans that are happening. There's like I've said, in many states, there are anti-trans bills that are being passed. There's a mass push of legislation restricting the rights of trans people across the country. Actually, if you even look at this week, GOP lawmakers in North Carolina introduced a bill that would prevent doctors from performing gender-confirming surgery for people under 21. So there's a lot that is happening here. We have to walk and chew gum at the same time, and we can do this. And it's important for us to keep our eyes on all the things that are happening. And then they came for us and we were like, fuck no. And then they came from my neighbor and I said, oh, no, not today. So wanted to, we didn't talk about that in the show, but I did want to make sure that was at the top of the show and on our radar here to pick up the fight, contact your local state legislatures, be an ally to those who need it. This is an attack on some folks' personage. It's heavy and it's a lot. So y'all know what to do. Get to work, be an ally, because that's just what we do, because it's Minority Corner and together we're the majority. Oh, I'm already saying the tagline. We're not even all the way into the show. All right, we're going to jump into it. I'll see you at the end for the fact check. And here we go. My supernova girl.
Supernova girl.
I just took that over from you. That was Xenon, girl from the 21st century. If you're
yes,
coming live at us.
You know, and now we're here in the 21st century and I want a refund.
Shit.
I'm not a fan. Right. I don't know who made these decisions. Yeah, I don't like how the episode is playing out.
Do we blame Kirsten Storms from this? Kirsten Storms, Xenon. I grew up with her watching Days of Our Lives.
I thought you meant you literally grew up with her, and I was like, she seems so nice.
Not that exciting, no. But I wonder if Raven Simone is also in Xenon. If you guys are, what drugs are they on? Well, we're on Disney drugs. Raven Simone, I had this theory. I woke up this morning and I had like the first thought, you know, like when you wake up in the morning and your first thoughts, maybe it's just me. My first thought was, I don't think Raven Simone does the third of any movie because she didn't do the third Cheetah Girls and she didn't do the third Xenon. In fact, in the third Xenon, I think they just said like a quick, she's like, I'm on the moon, and did like a little green screen. And she was like, oh, I'm busy, I can't come meet you. And
is there some kind of like magic afoot? Like, is it like,
maybe
genies
she's just
and wishes, like it would be the last one?
Or I think she's just like, by the time there's a third one, Raven's like, I'm out. Where's my check? Like, this is fine. I'm out.
It's fair.
But that's, I do fair. Know, we talked about on the podcast before, she did have beef with, I went down this rabbit hole because I was re-listening to 3LW, and two of the girls in 3LW are actually in the Cheetah Girls.
Yes.
Which that was confusing. Because they also were like too old, I thought, to even be in the Cheetah Girls. Because it was like, well, y'all had already done your own, like you were a girl group. And then they like were like, we're making sexy, nasty music with P. Diddy. And then they were like, just kidding, we're on the Disney Channel, we're the Cheetah Girls.
I mean, honestly, like what an arc. What an arc. You know, because isn't that always how it goes though? Like every music artist, they like come out, they're young, they're fresh, they're cute, and then they're like, I've got to like edge it up. I'm nasty. I'm wearing assless chaps in a wrestling ring, being nerdy. And then they're like, wait, I need my come to Jesus moment. I need to like remind, I need to go back to my roots, whatever they are. Right. And I need to show everyone that I am more than what I just did.
I will say the caveat, the thing that we all just have to like, in the era of calling spades and drawing attention to thing, is that a lot of times the white princess Pop-Tarts will then, when they're during their dirty, nasty stage, what they do is they're like, I go to hip hop. As if they're like trying to like date a black guy to make their parents mad or something, right? And and so then they go back to, I feel like Miley has done this, and they go back to like, oh, just kidding, I'm just, you know, I'm back to being just Miley, or before she was being Miley or Hannah. I don't know. Anyways,
it's, Miley Cyrus hits like a really weird chord with me in particular with that one, because like I don't know if you ever saw, like, in that whole era of the bangers era, did you see the music video for 23?
I don't even think I know what that song is. I know Taylor Swift has a 23 song, right? Oh, I'm being 22. I'm not
22.
Old.
Well, then, but I mean, Blink 182's 23 will always like supersede like anyone else's 23.
Let me tell you, that 23 came and went, because I was like, whoa, no one's going to like me when I'm 23. And then before I knew it, that time has already came and passed. Like, you know, like like, oh man, one day I'm going to be 23. That song has no relevancy to me. It has not. For well over a decade. Decades.
No one would know. That skincare regime, drop it. Drop it in the chat.
Black don't crack, but oil of the lay makes the face stay, as my mom told me on my 25th birthday. So, yes. Well, anyways, long story long, I think there's some beef before the between Adrienne of the Cheetah Girls and Raven, and then the other one. So there will no reunion.
Ooh.
No reunion.
Meanwhile, what's her name? Sabrina's just like, guys, can't we all get along?
That's it, 100%. She's like, she's literally the Michelle of the group, just like trying to get another check.
Right, dancing with the stars.
Oh, was she?
She was. I mean, who wasn't
Did
at this
she
point?
Win?
But she was.
Okay. She's still there?
I don't know.
She's still dancing with the stars? She's on set?
So the only reason
Let her
know
COVID hit and we're not filming right now.
We're just like, ma'am? The only reason I know anything about Dancing with the Stars is because my nanay, who's Filipino, is obsessed with it because Cheryl is on it. And Cheryl is a Filipino dancer.
Cheryl Sandberg. No.
No.
Who is Cheryl Sandberg?
I was
so about to like impress myself. I was like, I know a Cheryl. What's that Cheryl name that I heard all the time? I think Cheryl Sandberg works at Facebook. I think that's Cheryl Sandberg.
You know?
Cheryl Sandberg, I think, is the lean in lady. Tell us. All right. Chief Operating Officer of Facebook.
Yes. See, that to me is more impressive.
I mean, like, knowing things.
She's well rounded.
She also looks like the head of the CDC who told us recently that she is frightened for the world. Everybody hold on to your butts. Go back inside. Put your mask on.
I mean,
get it together, folks.
At this point, there's kind of like no real excuse. Like, masks are cute now. We've got my mom recently just bought a mask and it's like black fringe, like going down the whole front of the mask. And of course, someone at her job was like, Eileen, you look like a stripper. And I was like, yes, my mother, a Filipino woman in her late 50s, definitely in her airline uniform, just walking around.
Can I ask what was the race of the colleague? Because this seems
she was white.
And okay, I don't, yeah. I didn't need to ask for myself. I just needed to ask for the listeners, because that seems very coded into a lot of the things that we're going to be talking about, into the history of racial interpretations, especially when it comes to the AAPI community. But
yes,
speaking of, so we've been planning to get you onto the Minority Corner podcast for the longest time. Yeti screwed you over. Your mic was supposed to come, and you know,
I've never been more betrayed.
I am a Beyonce when it comes to podcasting, and I usually will not let someone on the Minority Corner stage without a Yeti mic, but these times call for, you know, to be less of a Beyonce and more of a Kelly, where it's just like, let's just do the work, right? Let's just come together. Say yes. If it's Freddy versus Jason, I'm into it. I don't care. Not that. Well, this is a horror movie. We're living in an American horror movie.
Oh, yeah. No, this is definitely the future everybody saw coming who, like, was paying attention. Yeah. I remember I was having talks with just, like, coworkers and people I knew when the 2020 election was coming up. And, you know, everyone's like, guys, you don't realize, like, if Trump wins this election, it's over. It's over for everyone. And I was like, you know what's really funny is that all of your, like, friends who are queer and people of color, like, it was over for us 4 years ago, and we've been kind of, like, asking for your attention. But now that you're like, oh, no, fascist regime, that could, like, affect me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now you think it's, like, doom and gloom and all of this stuff because you will suddenly, like, when we were like, hey, we're, like, having all our rights stripped away, and you're like, that's terrible.
Yeah.
And then it's, but now, oh, no. And, like, I don't doubt it would have been, like, way, way worse in general. No. But the fact that it's, like,
but there's
the panic set in 4 years later, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and there's certain people who are just on the front lines and on the chopping block and couldn't afford another 4 years or couldn't afford to just sort of sit back until the boiling water got too hot. And so, you know, now I don't, like, how has this been for you recently with having it? And you and I were talking, it's not so much that, like, and yes, I don't want to negate, like, yes, there's been a rise and there's the recent violent attacks, but these attacks aren't necessarily new.
No.
In terms of, like, there's it's sort of like a coming to light towards, oh, yeah, racism is happening towards the AAPI community as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's built into the fabric of the country, right? Like, yeah. I know the last time I was on the podcast, we talked a lot about how the very first piece of anti-immigration legislation ever written in the United States was the PAGE Act, which preceded the Chinese Exclusion Act.
Right.
And it was just about Asian women. And it was the fear that all Asian women were prostitutes and they were no longer allowed into the country. So, you know, seeing the shooting in Atlanta and that it was, you know, six Asian women who had been murdered and that, you know, there's all the talk around whether or not they were consensually working at these parlors, and just like it's so not a surprise. Mm-hmm. It was a tragedy, and it was like definitely one of those things that like rocks you, but it wasn't a surprise. It was kind of inevitable. I think xenophobia against Asian people is one of those things that it was always like sort of like the more acceptable form of racism because of the model minority myth. You know, because it's like, oh, well, you know, because they have it easier than other groups, like it doesn't happen to them, or like,
yeah,
you know, but like I can't think of like one Asian person I know who hasn't been like, you know, had their eyes pulled back at them, or like one Asian woman who hasn't heard like love me long time, sucky sucky, like the whole thing, you know?
Yeah.
Not one, not one. But I also don't know one person who hasn't done like a broken English accent as a joke, like in general. Because I know I've been talking a lot about race with my white friends, my black friends. And we talk about it, and I'll be like, I mean, have you ever laughed at someone doing a broken English accent, or like done one yourself as like part of a joke? And everyone's like, oh shit, yeah, no, I've definitely done that at least one time. Like, yeah, but like it doesn't occur to you that it's like a racist thing, you know, especially when you're like a kid, because it's so deeply ingrained in the culture.
Right.
You know?
And it's like you said, it's almost like the last sort of acceptable, quote unquote, when I say acceptable, y'all can't, you know, you're listening and I'm doing air quotes, but like there's it's been the last acceptable sort of racism, not even the last one, but it is almost more so acceptable compared to the other forms. Like I said this last week, that there's not like the direct N word to be able to say, oh no, not that. Like there's even like, you know, Jay Leno recently finally coming to the party, welcomes Space and Grace, but made apologies for jokes that he's made on his late night talk show, going out to like, you know, everybody. And he is one of so many, and that words matter. These moments matter. These things matter.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because it's Asian people have always been at sort of a weird precipice. Right. And I think that, this has been a huge reckoning for like millennial Asians and younger, because, you know, for us, it's like, you know, most of us are too young to remember Vincent Chin, like too young to remember the Vietnam War, too young to remember like internment, even if we have family members who went through those things. This is sort of the biggest like pivotal event for us politically. And I know that generationally there are so many issues with Asian families of sort of like having like racist parents or grandparents still, who are just like, oh yeah, they like are fully in the American dream, like America can do no wrong, like they are 100% like nationalist, like, you know, they're like, oh, you know, like we are better than like black and brown people, we worked harder, like that's why we're successful and they're not. And us having to be like, no, that's kind of like not what happened, and that's not true. But at the same time, like appropriating black culture is a really big issue with like other Asian people too, so it's, we're kind of not making any friends.
And I want you to continue on that, but I do want to, you know, not that like the grandparents need protecting, but like I want to point like a blame or attention to where it should be. Like when you're in an argument with your partner, it's not like I'm mad at my partner, I'm mad at, we're both trying to tackle the issue, right? And so the issue is it's the caste system. And so I understand, like I'm always like trying to get like, you know, everyone's fighting to there's a caste system, and the winners, white, is if you can make it to white, like ding ding ding, you're winning the game of America caste system, right? Like the French and the Irish and the Irish made it out, they're white now, they won, woo. Irish, you're white now. Italians, you're white now, y'all made it out, right? And so you have all these different folks who are coming over here trying to, like, you know, just part to get out of this rat race and to survive. And so when they come over and they're told, well, that's the worst thing you can be. And you see the treatment of like, oh, I don't want to be treated like that. Oh, I don't want to be like that. And then you're told, oh, you know, also don't be like that group of people, those, you know, black people, da 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 da. So I just wanted to, like, I get why that happens, not to say that there's not work in terms of like the deprogramming, because I think it's twofold. Like I've heard, you know, when with there's truth and reconciliation that has to happen here in this moment. I think there's healing from, it's so weird. Like it's bringing up so like the healing between the Black and the AAPI community. Like, and it's weird because like I grew up, like all my best friends were Filipino, and I grew up with like the Asian American, I grew up with like all my Asian American friends, and was in hip hop dance team at Hollow and at UCSC. And like, there was all Asian people, like, you know? And so I didn't know the hurt or between the two communities, honestly, until I saw Crash and I saw these, like, this Black person and this Asian American person yelling at each other. I'm like, that's so weird. I feel like that would never happen. I mean, Rush Hour, like, I thought we had such like love for each other's like culture, but then unpacking it throughout the, you know, the history of it where, you know, the attacks here in Oakland, some of them were by Black men, right? And then so, or even just across the country towards Asian American folks. Or I also know, you know, for Black people who've experienced racism from Asian American folks or being followed in a store. And so I think it's something that you're saying too. It's like with the millennials, though, I feel like we're the generation breaking that because we have friends outside of our own race. So we're able to be like, oh, that's not my experience, or I don't know, I'm not gonna play that, or I'm not gonna dive into that stereotype or do that broken English accent because I have friends, and that is the empathy is able to sit there, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there's also like, as someone who like built a career, like an early career on a broken Asian accent, and sort of like the reckoning I've had to go through with that whole fucking thing. Mm. I have done Avenue Q for a fourth time since the last time we talked.
Okay. Well, you've got to pay them bills. And, yeah, man. And that's also I understand that. Like, that's a issue with the industry and the lack of work and like with the roles. Like, I think we can put like Avenue Q, and I even think what's the other one they did, the Mormon one, like put them in a time capsule. Yeah. We're moving on because like we're not, and that's how we got to the stage where it was like, oh yeah, these two straight white guys can tell it like it is and tell it like it is for these communities and tell us about racism without any work or education or understanding.
I don't know if you know this, but Bobby Lopez, who wrote Avenue Q and Book of Mormon and Frozen, he's a quarter Filipino. I think he might be like a little more, but he's Asian.
Okay.
Oh. Which, I mean, it just bleeds into this whole thing of like,
I mean, listen, Stacey Dash is Black, so what you want?
Okay. Like, let's.
I mean, I don't know. I don't know anybody gets a pass for, you know, doing or saying the wrong
thing. I did see that she like released an apology of sorts.
I saw that she was in jail. I don't know. This is the Stacey Dash rumor mill. In fact, I just want to start a podcast that's just like the Stacey Dash rumor mill, or like, I don't even know what you would call it. Like, well, no, because I am. Mm-hmm. I forgot. I'm rooting for everybody Black, so that's hard. So Stacey Dash just do better. So
I think it's one of those things where it's like, everyone's got to like, once you've hurt someone, you have to earn trust, right? Like, she needs to earn trust.
Yes. Right? Yes. Or just like go to like Clueless midnight screenings and just smile and wave and just be like, I like totally had fun filming this movie. And we'll be like, yay. And then we'll be like, and like say some of the lines, Dion, and she's like, at least I wouldn't skin a collie to make my backpack. And we're like, yay. Or she goes, I do not wear polyester hair, unlike some people I know, like Shawanda. I mean, like, let's just do the greatest hits of Dion and then collect your check. And that's it. I don't need her to say anything from her own like personal life or beliefs.
You know, just it's like
collect checks, me and Dion.
Who lives, who dies, who tells your story? Like, it's,
what is that one thing, you live long enough for your heroes to become the villain.
Yeah, you die a hero or live long enough to become a villain.
What is that from?
It's like an old saying, but I know that people have been like replacing it. Like, it's like, you know, you die a SpongeBob or you live to become a Squidward. Like, people just started putting like their own stuff on it. So I guess for her it's like, you die a Dion or you live to become, you know, yourself on Fox. Like,
Minority Corner is supported in part by Audible, introducing the new Audible original, We've Got Answers, Honest Conversations on Race in America. This is created by cultural icon and best-selling author Charlemagne the God with James Altucher. Not this James, that James. And in this podcast, we're the most basic, sincere, and yes, at times, wildly ignorant questions about Black America and racial inequalities get unequivocally answered one by one. Yes, they go into it. And this is all done by today's leading Black experts and thought leaders in their field. It is including Tamika Mallory, Dr. Claude Anderson, Ebony K. Williams, David Banner, Reverend William Barber II, and so many more. So enter a one-of-a-kind safe space for quote-unquote unsafe conversations. Y'all can check out Charlemagne the God's We've Got Answers. And to listen free with a trial, all you gotta do is just go to audible.com/thatgod. That is audible.com/THAGOD. That's audible.com/thatgod. Are you ready to listen?
I started listening to Ono, Ross, and Carrie shortly after I broke my arm.
I couldn't get my book started.
I was lost, honestly.
I knew it was time to make a change.
There's something about Oh No, Ross and Carrie that you just can't get anywhere else.
They're thought leaders, discoverers, founders.
I'd call them heroes.
Ross and Carrie don't just report on fringe science, spirituality, and claims of the paranormal. They take part themselves.
They show up so you don't have to.
But you might find that you want to.
Arm is better.
I wrote an entire book this weekend. It's terrible, but I did it.
Just go to MaximumFun.org.
Thank you, Ross and Carrie.
Ono, Ross and Carrie is just a podcast. It doesn't do anything. It's just sounds you listen to in your ears. All these people are made up. Goodbye.
I would like to tell a story about someone, but I don't know if I'm the right person now to tell this story about Vincent Chin.
I would love to hear you tell the story because I like knowing somebody else fucking knows.
Yes.
Like,
yeah,
absolutely. You know?
So, well, thank you for that. That was, I think there's a good solid button there. And so, you know, when you're saying is that like this man did this act of violence under this guise of this under his interpretation of what he thought these Asian women were, right? And so again, representation in media matters, and y'all, like, you know, take center stage, like tell these stories. We need to create more space for that to even happen. I want to, I know you were saying you're tired of hearing stories about y'all dying, and
I said I was tired about them being the only stories.
Yes. Well, because I wanted to highlight a story about Vincent Chin. And I was thinking about this is that like, and I was like, oh, should I? But I was like thinking, I was like, I don't shy away from talking about Matthew Shepard. I don't shy away from talking about, you know, Rodney King. And we have, you know, the George Floyd case is now being tried right now. And there's a lot of parallels. And again, you know,
the Derek Chauvin case. George Floyd famously didn't get a trial.
Right. Well, yes, thank you for pointing that out. Yeah with the Derek Chauvin case, who I think I just hate saying their names is my thing. But yes.
Oh my, I hadn't even thought
of
that.
Yeah, like I don't even like talk, like, because I always remember like Dylan Roof. I'm like, gross, I don't want to remember that guy's name. Like, so I try not to recycle that, but you're right. But the case about George
Floyd. You're also right, though.
The case about George Floyd's murder. That's the name to me that, you know, matters. And so, you know, I wanted to highlight, you know, the story about Vincent Chin. You're talking about stories matter. It is but wild to me that the story about Vincent Chin, there is a play about it. Because when I was producing it, when I was a graduate student at UC Santa Cruz, when I was artistic director, I produced this show, a friend of mine, she's an amazing, talented director, and she wanted to do this show about Vincent Chin. I had not heard about him until she did this show, and it was it's called Carry the Tiger to the Mountain. It was such a beautiful, amazing show, and it's about, you know, the murder of Vincent Chin and the legacy that it sparked in this new rise in Asian American activism, this sort of resurgence of it in the 1980s and what it created. So kind of giving the backstories about the 1980s, anti-Asian sentiment was on the rise, but like, had it ever really left? It was always really there.
It ebbs and flows.
Ebbs and flows. What was back underneath, you know, Ronald Reagan, here it comes. The Japanese economy was booming. Japanese cars were popping. Everyone was like, let me get these cars. And Japanese banks were also buying up American companies. And so there's this rise in so a lot of, like, you know, Japanese businesses here in the U.S. And, you know, U.S. car manufacturing companies are going on the decline. And there's a scapegoating that starts to happen. And it's like, but who is in charge of the laws that, like, you know, listen, capitalism's going to capitalism, and it's going to go for the cheapest labor wherever it can, you know, sort of find. And it's the same sort of situations like today. People end up out of work, and there's always a scapegoat. And so the Japanese at the time in the 1980s were made an easy target for politicians, the unemployed. So that's the backdrop of going on, you know, with Vincent Chin. He born and grew up in Detroit with his adoptive, born in China, grew up in Detroit, was adopted by Chinese American parents. And in the summer of 1982, he was 27. He worked on computer graphics, and Detroit was this, you know, booming car industry. But like I said, greedy American politics and stuff, it's destruction of this American, you know, industry or whatnot. So again, Vincent Chin is Chinese, right? So really, I'm talking about all this stuff about Japan. What the fuck does it got to do with him? You are right to ask mm-hmm. that question and hold on to that, dear listener. So enter angry white man, a blue collar worker, which again, why is blue collar worker associated with just, like, you know, enter angry racist man. I'm not gonna call him no blue collar worker. So there we go. So on June 19th, 1982, Vincent Chin, he was out celebrating with his friends. He's about to get married. He's like living his best life. They're at a strip club. Okay, right? You know, and I it's interesting because I feel like that point can sometimes, like, it's the same thing with let's say, like, with in this example in Atlanta, let's say they were sex workers, right? Let's say that they were. Okay. Who cares? Does that mean that they're supposed to die? That's a whole entire other conversation about, okay, let's legalize sex work. Let's, you know, get people different rights. There's this demonization that sometimes happens to people who are just living,
associated with any kind of sexuality.
Any kind of sexuality. Like, okay, get off of that sort of high horse.
Especially if you're
especially
Asian.
Especially if you're Asian, right? So yes, he was at a bachelor party, at a strip club. What about it? That happened to be, I could have been like, he was at a Payless shoe store. Doesn't mean that he deserved to die. Those women did not deserve to die either. So 43-year-old Ronald Ebbins and his 22-year-old stepson, Michael Nitz, they'd lost their job at Chrysler, and they were at the club, upset and white, because listen, they were told that if you are white and you're a dude in America, you're going to be fine. You're going to be fine.
I want upset and white on a t-shirt.
They were upset and white. Like, okay, all right. That's every movie that we see. All right. Put on the Joker. All right.
66 point whatever percent.
And they're
yeah.
always like white male rage, angry. And then it gives them permission to keep acting out in this, like, foul way that does nobody a good service. And I also want to point out that their own, like, community be selling them out. Their own politicians, their own people be selling their jobs, like, across, like, you know. So be mad at somebody. Look at yourself. Look at yourself. Cast me as your best friend, and I'm going to give you that monologue. It's how you look at yourself. All right. So there was some...
I'll be the other best friend who's just rubbing the back with glasses on.
That's a role I won't mind playing. If I, like, you know, gather every white man and tell them, look at yourself, cast me in it. And it's the last time we have to have this conversation, I'm there. So there was an argument that took place, and my hunch, though, is that the white men provoked it. Allegedly, it was over the stripper, and according to testimony, a dispute erupted between the men over the stripper. And the dancer actually recalled, she said that she remembers them saying, Ebbins, the older man, 43, shouting at Vincent, it's because of you motherfuckers that were out of work. And a scuffle, it moved outside. Ebbins, the older man, grabbed a baseball bat and started chasing Vincent. And then Vincent ran away. And then these two assholes for 20 fucking minutes driving around for him. Driving around for him, right? Like, already
hunting.
Already bad enough that this was already happening. Couldn't just let it go. He left. It's gone. Y'all are racist. You know, they found him and they beat him to death with a baseball bat. And he died 4 days later on June 23rd from injuries. Sadly, my birthday. But, I hate seeing that number pop up in anything good. But you know what? Some people were born on the 11th of September, and I'm sure they have their own feelings. Or now, the 6th of January, right? You know?
Oh, yeah. I have a friend whose birthday is the 6th of January.
Your birthday's gone forever. You have no more birthday. Mm-hmm. So,
for your birthday, I'm just going to hire a bunch of white people to, like, break in and steal your cake. What a
terrible friend. That's a very Oh, are you doing this for her for next year? No, I will say no. Usually I would like to yes and your antics, but on that one, I have to say no. So,
oh, it was definitely a joke. I know,
but even, like, I can't even get...
Listeners, it was not serious. I know that it sounded bad, but let me assure you.
So, sentencing. So, that happened, and I'm sure you're like, well, of course, these people were put into jail. But remember, they weren't just people. They were white people. So, remember, this is, like, first-class status, right? So, at the time, the news didn't make national coverage. It wasn't a white girl who fell out on the well, so no one was paying attention. And the Asian community in Detroit was obviously deeply affected. There's a documentary called Vincent Hu, The Murder of a Chinese American Man, directed by Curtis Chin, who was a family friend. And he was pretty much saying that they're very, you know, affected by it, because it was like, if this could happen to Vincent, it could happen to anyone. And, like, anytime an attack, we have, you know, BIPOC folks have more of a connection to linked lineage, that when something happens to one of us, we feel like it could happen to all of us. Good or the bad, we feel it all. Like, people talking smack about Stacey Dash, I'm like, oh my God, that could be me. Good or the bad. So on March 16, 1983, a Wayne County circuit judge in the state v. Ronald Evans and Michael Nitz. So Evans, the older man, pled guilty, and his stepson Nitz pled no contest to the reduced charges of manslaughter. And the murder was ruled that it was no more than just a brawl. Boys being boys. It just got out of hand. It got out of hand. So they just each received a $3,000 fine and then a little $780 in court costs and 3 years of probation.
For admitting they were guilty.
Yeah, we did it. And then, like, the judge was like, oh, okay. Like, again, this is the system taking care of the people that it was designed to, right? And so it was classified as not a hate crime. Mm-hmm. And the victim's family was not even given the opportunity to speak at the sentencing. And this is when we talk about how invisible that the racism wasn't viewed as a hate crime. It was just boys being boys. Like, you can't take out someone's race from these situations. Like, it was absolutely. And we led, like, what was the context behind the cultural climate of the time? And that's how invisible the racism is towards the AAPI community. And it's just, it's quote unquote acceptable, or just, you know,
they're still trying to spin that the shooting in Atlanta wasn't a hate crime. They're, like, still pushing.
Yep. And we'll see.
It was sex
holding
addiction.
My breath. Listen, even with the current, I can't even watch the trial around the murder of George Floyd right now, because I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know. I don't have faith or hope, or I think one thing or another. I don't know. I don't know. So yeah. The judge said, these aren't the kind of men you send to jail. We're talking here about a man who's held down a responsible job for 17 or 18 years, and his son is employed and is a part-time student. You don't make the punishment fit the crime. You make the punishment fit the criminal. So, again, permission to be white, you're good to go. It's the caste system at work. And two, like, pointing out, like, affirmative, like, this is affirmative action for white people. Like, affirmative action does work. That college,
1,000%.
I don't know if you saw the college admissions, like, documentary on Netflix, but, like, legacies, like, oh, my dad went to Harvard.
Legacy is the biggest fucking bullshit thing.
Yes, 100%.
I know people with legacy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, got into the colleges their parents got into.
I mean,
and, like, you know, and
I just, it's one of those things where it's like, what is the point other than to keep certain kinds of people in an institution? You know, meanwhile, they're like blocking Asian people from being able to exceed certain numbers at certain schools.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
You know?
Well, and so obviously, so this, like, again, sparked like an uprising because, you know, folks were like, this is absolutely ridiculous, you know, because it became a license to kill, essentially. You know, that they essentially were given a license to kill for $3,000 if you had a steady job or were a student and the victim is Chinese, then you're totally fine. So Vincent Chin's mother, Lily Chin, became a huge activist working with, you know, different activists at the time. She wanted justice for her for her son. And it reminds me of, you know, the black mothers who are out there getting justice for their kids. And so Lily Chin was really, you know, wanted justice. And the murder didn't make national headlines, but the sentence did. There were protests that erupted. You know, there were examples of AAPI activism before this, but historians really note that this was like one of the turning points because, one, these racists were upset at Japanese folks, right? And they were set out to kill Vincent because they thought he was Japanese. Two, but he wasn't even Japanese. He was Chinese. Three, that's still not even great to begin with, but they don't see any, they don't see folks in the community as anything different. They're all lumped together. And so this really created a solidarity amongst the community to really come together and fight together because they were being lumped together. And, you know, since, you know, the 1965 Hart-Celler Act had lifted longstanding restrictions on Asian American immigrants, which had been there for decades and centuries, as we had talked about, like from like the Page Act of 1875, I believe it was. Let me know my numbers. And the Chinese immigration, the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, and so on. There were many laws like this, but the Hart Act was like, oh, okay, just kidding. I think, you know, some of y'all can come back in now. So the population was starting to change. There was starting to be more growth in terms of, you know, pan-Asian American representation. And so Helen Zia, who's a Chinese American journalist, and she worked with, you know, Lily Chin, his mother, other activists, engineers, volunteer lawyers, and others who came to create this movement. And they came together and they created the American Citizens for Justice, or the ACJ, and other, along with them and other groups, they did protests. They petitioned the U.S. Department of Justice to investigate Vincent Chin's murder as a civil rights violation. So it went up. It went to the United States versus Ebbins. And so there, the ACJ examined the possibility of having the Department of Justice bring a federal civil rights suit, which it did. And, you know, the ACJ went to work. They hosted picnics. They did runs. And so they had all these, you know, debates and conversations to really argue that, you know, on whether Asian Americans were protected underneath the federal civil rights laws. So the FBI investigated the case and the DOJ decided to go ahead and press civil rights charges, which was a huge, this was a huge deal. And so the jury actually found Ebbins to be guilty of federal civil rights violations and he was sentenced to 20 years in prison. And the jury found Nitz, his younger son, not guilty of civil rights violations because he didn't say anything racial. So it went back to the dancer's testimony and they were like, oh, well, okay, if she said that it was racist, then okay. Even though we could look at the climate and know what happened, who senselessly beats someone and follows them around and hunts them down? Like, that is just embedded hate. That is like, that is caste system hate at work there. So this sentencing marked the first time Asian Americans were a protected class in a federal civil rights prosecution. So the first time this was happening, that they were then now part of being the protected class. But remember, Ebbins is white, so he then appealed to the Sixth Circuit of Appeals, where a Cincinnati jury found him not guilty, and he was then cleared of all charges in 1987. Either one of these men served a full day in jail for their actions. You can take race out of it, they murdered someone, but you can't take race out of it, and I feel like it's because they murdered a person of color, specifically at this time period, an Asian American person, where that was pretty much okay.
Yeah, we also have to remember Japanese internment was only like 40 years before.
Japanese American internment. I have to.
George Takei, he got you.
Always, he got me. So every time I hear it, I'm just like, it was Japanese American.
Japanese American internment. I mean, it's an important thing to remember.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where it's like, the hardest thing about, like hearing those stories as like a young Asian American. Is the fact that, you know, it's having to come to terms with the crumbs that you wanted, right? It's having to be like, you know, yeah, like a lot of us have tried to get under the umbrella of whiteness, right? Because it's like...
For your own safety and survival.
For your own safety. You want, it's like... The biggest narrative in Asian families, and this is like almost across the board, is that your parents and your grandparents will drill into you, you have to assimilate. You have to become an American. Like, we're not going to teach you the language. We're not going to do any of this. Like,
I've even heard from some people, it's like you can, you know, date. This is from Asian and Southeast Asian. Mm-hmm. You know, you can date an... like whatever, like you're supposed, I've heard from friends who are like, you know, oh, you can date, you know, a Japanese person, you can date, and then if you can't do that, then date a white person, but don't date a black person, right? So it's like, it's, that's the worst thing you could do,
honestly. So gross. It's
and the I've heard that from not just the Japanese American folks, but like,
yeah,
I've heard that from friends of mine from all different of the different, you know, countries and cultures.
Yeah, it's gross, because it's like, it, they're saying it because they want the safety of not being associated with blackness. That's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's blatant. It's very much this like, oh, like we don't, it's, they don't want to admit that it's, they're afraid of facing anti-blackness.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't want to admit it. They don't want to look at you and be like, the reason I don't want you to date like a black man and have black kids is because then I will have black grandchildren. And I will have to reckon with that and with being afraid for them and with having to acknowledge that I can't pretend that it's not bad.
As opposed, and the reverse is do the work to dismantle these systems, because this shit is the bullshit. Otherwise, you're just participating, and then you're part of the problem as a part of the solution instead of the solution.
It's the and then they came for me. Right?
100%. Yes.
It's exactly that.
That is 110% that. Absolutely. And so just to cap off the story, though, is that like they were fined. Eventually, Ebbins and Nitz, they settled a civil suit in 87. They were ordered to pay $50,000 to the Chin estate over 10 years. And then Ebbins was then ordered to pay $1.5 million, which grew to an estimate of $8 million, and never paid it. Never paid it. So... it just, yeah, just putting that little, you know, again, if you are white, there are certain things that you're able to do. And going back to the conversation about representation matters, this should be a movie. And this isn't the only story. There's other stories where, you know, Asian American communities have been like ravaged by similar to Tulsa, right? Let's hear those stories.
Yeah.
The different riots that were put onto them. It wasn't necessarily them, but they were attacked. And then, but you know, white people always be like, oh, they rioted. No, they were attacked. You burnt down everything that they had. And so telling these stories, because this is American history. This is important for people to be able to hear all the different stories. And then I know what it's like to hear and see my heroes and have their stories told, and it makes me stand a little bit stronger up as well. So I want you all to have that too.
Thank you. And I have to say, I was so, so touched when you texted me after the Atlanta shooting and offering support and acknowledging specifically, like, as a black person seeing this happening to your community, I want to offer you like love and support and let you know that we're like there with you, you know? And I don't mean to get like super emotional. Like, I'm not opposed to the feelings of being emotional. It's more so the fact that it's like, it's hard to be a race of people that feels super invisible, except for when you're being made fun of. And then when you're being murdered. And I mean, Asian Americans have a lot of reparations we need to do with the Black community. A lot. Like, from, like, appropriating Black culture and, like, just general anti-Blackness in a lot of Asian communities, and that, like, a lot of us are really trying, you know, and that to have that kind of support and to have you, like, reach out and just, like, check in from a knowing place, it's, I remember telling you, I was angry that it had to come from a knowing place. Mm-hmm. And that, like, you reaching out to be like, I know what this feels like, and to be like, I hate that anybody feels like this.
Yeah.
You know, I, like I said, there's a difference between, like, feeling discriminated against and feeling racism and feeling hunted. Mm. And the past year has just been a hunt. And people are out, they're out for blood. And that's just been a whole different shift. And so I appreciate the support. I appreciate getting to speak on the podcast very much. And I appreciate you as a friend for checking in. And I think that, like, those are the kind of bridges that are going to, like, help all of us go forward, you know?
100%. I love it.
Yeah.
That's the last note. I want you to have the last note. That is it. That's the show.
Thank you.
Some mornings you wake up feeling ready to pull the covers over your head and go back to sleep because you were just so tired. And you know what? It's no judgment, y'all. I know it's supposed to be spring. It's supposed to be spring is sprung, but... if you're like me, it is so hard to get out of bed. And you know one of the reasons why it's hard for me to get out of the bed? Because my Brooke linen sheets are so comfortable, because I can legitimately say for the first time in my life, I genuinely love my sheets. And y'all know this because I've been talking about it for weeks. So Brooke Linen directly works with their manufacturers to make luxury available directly to you without the luxury level markups. None of that. And Brooke Linen, it's so much more than just sheets. They got comforters, they got pillows, they got towels, they even got loungewear. Because even though, you know, spring is here, you still need to lounge around and look and feel comfortable and cool as you do it. I've said this before, I'll say it again, I definitely love my Brooke Linen sheets. They are so comfortable. It is hard to get out of bed, but in a good way. Because I eventually do get out of bed because I had such a good night rest sleep in my comfy Brooke Linen sheets. And in fact, as soon as this show's over, I'm going to go get my Brooke Linen sheets, y'all, because they're so comfortable and I love them. Go to brooklinen.com and use promo code MINORITY to get $25 off when you spend $100 or more, plus free shipping. Yes, that is brooklinen.com and enter promo code MINORITY to get $25 off when you spend $100 or more. Let's and you get that free shipping. So that is brooklinen.com and use promo code MINORITY at checkout. Get your sleep on. You deserve it.
One, two, three, four. Hi, everybody. My name is Justin McElroy.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
We're both doctors and...
Nope, just me.
Okay, well, Sydney's a doctor and I'm a medical enthusiast and we create... Okay. Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine.
Every week I dig through the annals of medical history to bring you the wildest, grossest, sometimes dumbest tales of ways we've tried to treat people throughout history.
And lately we do a lot of modern fake medicine because everything's a disaster, but it's slightly less of a disaster every Friday right here on MaximumFun.org as we bring you Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine. And remember,
don't drill a hole in your head.
All right, well, there it is, Teresa. So wonderful to have her. A two-parter. There just was so much to talk about, so much to discuss. And the only fact check that I actually really have, remember we were citing that quote that you live long enough for your to see your heroes become the villain? That is actually a quote from Batman. It was DC, so not that I not a huge stan for DC, but I'm not the hugest. I mean, I see their movies. I saw Justice League Snyder Cut. I saw the Nolan trilogy. I've seen it. Just didn't realize that's where that quote was from. That is where that is from. Speaking of, you live long enough to see your heroes become the villain. I mean, talk about that's just like the last 2 years. You can name all the shows or the actors, or I don't know that Harvey Weinstein was anyone's hero, but Joss Whedon, if we can just say that, like, man, rest in peace to his career. Like, you're done. You're done. It's so heartbreaking, just all the revelations that have been coming up about Joss Whedon that have been trickling. I, as a fan of Joss Whedon, of all of his shows and work, there's an episode, you can go into the archives, like 2-3 years ago, and I was recounting an article where someone was just revealing just all the shady shenanigans and things of him. And if you kind of look at some of his writing and some of his treatment about, like, with women on set that was coming out, it was more than meets the eye. It was a transformer, a bad transformer. What is that? A Decepticon? That's right. Joss Whedon, a Decepticon. So, and we all knew when, you know, fired Charisma Carpenter because she was pregnant. If you're watching Angel, and it was just a weird storyline the way that ended. And then his Wonder Woman script apparently was just so trash and so incredibly sexist that we definitely dodged a bullet there. And just, again, all the stuff that's coming up with, like, Ray Fisher and even Gal. Even Gal is like, there's been some things that's coming out about her experiences with Joss Whedon and how he was rewriting lines and just really changing up the character than what she was before. And also with Jason Momoa, like, be funnier. And just all these things that, like, the women in the POCs on Justice League were having a certain kind of experience. And maybe in Avengers, the first one, they didn't have quite that experience because it mainly was all white dudes and Scarlett Johansson. So there it is. But everything done in the dark will come to light one day. And my one quick rejuvenation station as we get out of here is, I've said this before, I'm a huge proponent and a fan. Get into therapy now. Get into therapy now before it is too late. And if you are with a therapist and you feel like you've maybe hit a wall, if you worked with them as long as you can, maybe it's okay to go to a different therapist or to try different therapists out. Sometimes we spend more time looking for a new car than we do the right therapist. And we are more important than a car, folks. I recently found a new therapist who hugs closer to my identity. He's black and he's gay and he's just so fabulous and so amazing. And I'm really excited about the work that we are going to do because I had hit a wall with my last therapist. We had worked on what we needed to do. And I felt like I needed to find someone that was more closer to my identity and just so I could just let my hair down and just go right into it. But that's my advice. Get into therapy now before it's too late and find the right therapist for you. It's okay to try different type of therapists or therapy, but just make sure that you're doing that thing for yourself each day. And my last bit of rejuvenation station, my challenge to you, is every morning or every week, but maybe try every morning, set an intention. What is your intention for today? And it can be something as simple as, I'm going to remember to breathe today, or I'm going to remember to practice gratitude today, or I'm going to remember to go for a walk today, or this week, I'm going to practice gratitude before I go to bed, or I'm going to make sure I go on at least 3 walks this week. Just setting some sort of health, self-help, self-love, self-care, rejuvenating intention for yourself. Or I'm gonna, you know, let things roll off my back, or I'm gonna end work at by 6 p.m. whatever that intention is for you, that you know what it is, because when I said it, you thought, oh yeah, that's what my intention will be for this week or for today. Set an intention every day or every week. All right, and then see how you do, and don't beat yourself up if you didn't, you know, meet it. Okay, well, that is the show. You all know we love hearing from you. We love hearing from you. You can write us the reviews on wherever you podcast. You can also meet us on the Facebook page. You can write us on the Twitters, the Instagrams. We would love to hear from you. You can write us an email, minoritycorner@gmail.com. Find us on Instagram or Twitter @minoritycorner. Before I forget, the Maximum Fun Drive is coming up and we would love to hear from you. We would love to hear from you. If you become a member, why did you become a member? We want to hear from you. So you can email memberstories@maximumfun.org, or you can call the Google hotline and leave a voicemail at 323-601-8719. Again, that is 323-601-8719, or email memberstories@maximumfun.org. We want to hear from you because this show does not happen without our members, and we want to hear from you as we get ready for the Maximum Fun Drive, and maybe we'll play your voice memo or read your responds on the show, because this is, you all helped to create the show. We can't do it without you. So we want to include you in all the fun. You know, do you have a story about what our show means to you, or how you found us, or the impact that it's had? We want to hear all of that. Okay, that's going to do it for us. Big thank you to Sam Jackson, our social media manager, and Sarah Brown, the editor, making it all happen. And thank you for listening to Minority Corner, because together, we're the majority. Love y'all.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.